We're learning about an invasive earthworm introduced from Eastern Asia called crazy worms or jumping worms here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Scientists say these unusual worms are a danger to our forests, our animals, and plants. And over the years, they've spread to more than a dozen states, including here in Wisconsin. Have you come across a so-called crazy worm? Where did you see it? What did you observe? What do you want to know about these worms? It's 800-642-1234. Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Brad, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a visual in our mind's eye, if you will. What do these worms look like?
So to the, I guess, the untrained eye, they're like just like every other earthworm, you know, similar to the night crawler that we're used to for fishing. But they're where they're invaded, they are much, much more abundant. And since they really only live in the top few centimeters of soil, they're much more apparent because you just see them much more often. But generally, they're just kind of a brownish red worm. As adults, though, the biggest difference is that they have this white ring near their head. It's called the clitellum, and it's where they produce these cocoons, their offspring. And when I give talks to Master Gardener and other folks, I always emphasize this white ring because that's by far the easiest way to identify them.
That's their defining feature, yeah. What about their movements and behavior? Do they actually jump?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's the other thing that we talk about, too, is they are called jumping worms commonly for a reason. And they don't, you know, they don't have legs, so they're not jumping like you and I might think of jumping, but they thrash around quite a bit. And they can, you know, they have more of a rigid body than other earthworms. And so because of that anatomy, they can lift themselves off the ground just by flopping around and thrashing. And so it appears that they are jumping, but they don't have legs. So they're not, you know, actually jumping. But the other behavior is that they act like a snake sometimes. So they're also called snake worms.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this S, kind of like snakes do, to get away from predators. They just make the S shape as they're scooting away. So, and some of them are really long. And so I've had folks thinking that they have these new weird snakes in their garden when they're just these new creepy earthworms.
So they can actually get bigger than we would imagine our typical earthworm. You know, I saw this video of you holding one, and as you touched it, it would jump. And I wonder, does it respond to touch?
Yeah, right. So we don't know a lot about sort of the reasons for that behavior, other than it's likely has to do with disturbance or getting away from predators. So, right, if you unearth one, so to speak, it may not exhibit that jumping or snake behavior until you touch it and kind of, you know, not to anthropomorphize earthworms, but annoy it a little bit.
Hmm.
And then that's when it'll likely exhibit that thrashing behavior or snaking behavior. That's when you would most likely see it, when it gets disturbed.
And Brad, give us some historical reference here on where they came from and when they arrived here in Wisconsin.
Right. So depending on there's many species of jumping worms. In fact, there's hundreds of different species. And in North America, we have about 17 different species. And they're generally from Southeastern Asia, China, the Korean Peninsula, and Japan. And interestingly enough, there's been records of a couple species of jumping worms in the lower 48 back to the turn of the 20th century.
Maine said they found one in a greenhouse in 1899.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So some of them are not necessarily new, quote unquote, invaders or, you know, earthworms to the continent. However, for whatever reason, those early invasions or those early introductions did not become invasive. They did not spread. And, you know, they've been down in the southeast part of the country as well. Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, for decades. And for whatever reason, though, the last 15 years or so, 20 years, they've really started to move. They've moved up the Eastern Seaboard, now to the Midwest. And we actually have records of them being in about 37 states now.
Wow.
And you know, we don't, scientists, you know, we don't know why all of a sudden there was some threshold, some trigger that really, you know, expanded their range. You know, it's potentially some climate change happening, or just, you know, densely populated areas and moving of materials that have these jumping worms in them, or their cocoons just happened, and they've taken advantage of it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with ecologist Brad Herrick of UW-Madison's Arboretum about these jumping worms, and he assists in developing long-term restoration plans for Arboretum lands. You can join in. Do you have jumping worms in your area or in your backyard? What would you like to know about them? What have you observed? 800-642-1234. Brad, getting into the ecology here, what threat do these worms have on Wisconsin forests?
Right. So we're just sort of you know, touching the surface now of the potential impacts of this new invasive species, yet another invasive species to Wisconsin. And, you know, what we know kind of so far is that they drastically change the soil. So in terms of the soil chemistry, how nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus that are really important for plant growth, they change the availability of those nutrients, often reducing them in the soil, and they change the structure of the soil. So this is another key way to tell if you have jumping worms or not. In your yard or in a forest, without actually seeing the worms, because they leave in their wake what we think is a permanent structural change in the soil. It looks like coffee grounds, or I've heard it described as taco meat, which is, I think, a less appealing way to think about it. But very granular, just little beads of soil that, from what we can tell, do not hold moisture as well. Is highly erodible and are high in nutrients, but those nutrients are tied up in these little beads of soil and are not able to get down to the root zone. And so that's one of the biggest changes that we're seeing. And, you know, we don't know, because this is a relatively new invasion, we still don't know what the long-term impacts of just the soil changes might be to plant growth, to amphibians that are using the soil, to other soil arthropods. And so that's still out there. We haven't seen any drastic changes to the plant community, although there is some indication. It's a different story in gardens. I'm hearing lots of stories about garden plants, whether they're ornamentals or natives, struggling. A lot of the impacts to forests are still unknown.
Lots of question marks.
Soil structure changes.
Well, let's take a call. Patty is joining us in Sheboygan. Hi, Patty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. We live on 8 acres of a wooded property, and some of the acreage does have stunts. I do have ornamental flowers. I did notice jumping worms in my beds. Is it true if you slice them in half with a shovel that you'll now have two growing? And then my second question is, if I pour like an ammonia or a vinegar in the soil, will that help kill the ache?
Patty, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Patty. Good question. So I get this first question a lot. If you slice earthworm in half, do you now have two earthworms? And the answer is absolutely not. That will probably kill the earthworm, although they can survive with just being a shorter earthworm as long as their clitellum, that reproductive area, is still intact. So you are not creating two earthworms. Don't worry about that. And then the other question about pouring vinegar or an ammonia product into your soil. Folks are trying that. I don't know much about the ammonia application, but I have heard that a vinegar and water solution will definitely, on contact at least, will definitely kill the earthworms.
In what proportions, approximately?
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty low, low rate. You don't need much. Now, a caveat there is that we do not know the impacts of doing this kind of work on plants, on soil pH. They likely have other impacts that we don't know yet. And so I just kind of caution people to maybe try it in an area and just see what kind of impact they're seeing in terms of plant health. It will not affect cocoons, though. That's the problem with a lot of these applications, is that these cocoons have a hard shell, and we have not found anything as of yet that can penetrate that shell. But there is work that will be starting up hopefully pretty soon on looking at that part of their life cycle.
Yeah, we're going to look more at their reproduction with Brad Herrick, who's explaining crazy worms or jumping worms. He is a UW-Madison Arboretum ecologist. Do you have jumping worms in your area? What would you like to know about them? Have you had a problem with these worms? What did they do to your soil? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brad Herrick here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss the effects of crazy worms. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers have been studying what these invasive worms will do to the health of our forests and how to control established populations. Gardeners, what are your observations of these worms and what have you done to control them? According to the state of Maine's horticulture program, crazy worms are native to Korea and Japan and are now found from Maine to South Carolina and westward to our state. What is your experience with them? Have you come across them sold as fishing bait? Join in 800-642-1234. We have ecologist Brad Herrick, who is research manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Brad, can you explain their life cycle and how they reproduce?
Yes, definitely. And this is one way that we can separate them from all other earthworms that we might see in our environment. They have an annual life cycle. And so in the spring, they hatch from these little 2-millimeter cocoons that look just like soil. So they're very hard to see in the soil. They will hatch in those cocoons. And in about 2 months or so, they become mature. And so by mid-summer, you're going to start right about now. You're going to start to see a lot of these mature earthworms. And then they will, as far as we know, just kind of periodically produce cocoons. Mm-hmm. And until the first hard freeze, usually in our part of the state, sometime in mid-October. Once that happens, then the adult worms, all the earthworms, will die. But those cocoons will survive our winter, and they'll overwinter until the next spring, where they'll hatch again. And so it is a true annual life cycle, which is pretty remarkable for this this invasive species that, you know, there are no alive earthworms for a bulk of the year, but yet they can still spread and be quite abundant during the summer.
Yeah, so they have like these winter tents that hold them over.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. And, you know, they can produce many cocoons each individually. And if you have a high abundance of earthworms, you have a lot of cocoons. And it's very different than other earthworms that are able to dig into the soil below the frost line and survive. And so that's one of the reasons why we talk about that a lot, is because if people see large earthworms in like April or May, those are very unlikely to be jumping worms because they haven't matured yet. And so those are going to be some other type of earthworms at that point of year.
Well, you know, Brad, there are so many different invasive plants and animals out there that invade our natural habitat in, you know, countless ways. Where do crazy worms fall in the continuum of least concerning to most concerning invasive?
Well, I'm probably biased here, but I think they're up near the top at this point. And they're still somewhat unknown, surprisingly. But the reason why they're still unknown, it's likely because they're pretty cryptic, right? They're earthworms, and so you may not see them in the soil if you're just walking through the forest, like you would buckthorn or a stand of ash trees that's been attacked by emerald ash borer, garlic mustard that's very obvious, but the damage that they can do to the soil and how quickly they are moving throughout the U.S. and into Canada. I think really puts them near the top of these new invaders, and the fact that they are spreading faster, and there's more questions from the public than we have answers to. So that's what makes them even particularly more, scary, is that we don't know what the long-term effects are. We don't know a lot of these basic biology questions, because, this is a new invasive. And so we're trying to get up to speed with answers.
Well, researchers also think perhaps that these worms threaten sugar maple trees. And in Wisconsin, of course, we produce hundreds of thousands of gallons of maple syrup a year. Are you concerned these worms could affect maple syrup output?
Absolutely. Yeah. Sugar maple is a very common tree, not only in Wisconsin, but throughout the upper Midwest and New England. Maple syrup, as well as, just hardwood, other uses for maple wood. That's definitely a concern. And there are some studies going on in Vermont and other places looking at potential, how do they affect sugar maple establishment? Mm-hmm. And how do they affect just their growth and health and, trickling down to the more commodity, the sugar maple or the maple syrup manufacturing. And so, that's definitely one of the sort of biggest concerns that we have, is just with that resource, which affects, a big part of the economy.
We're talking with ecologist Brad Herrick of UW-Madison's Arboretum, explaining the effects of non-native jumping worms in Wisconsin, the spread of these worms in North America. Do you have jumping worms? Have you ever seen one? What have been the effects to your soil, to your garden, to your landscape? 800-642-1234. Brad, at this point in trying to get tackle the biology and start answering a lot of these questions, how important is the citizen science, the observations at this point?
They are critical, to be honest. They're spreading at such a rate that, scientists alone or even graduate students cannot, track them fast enough and learn enough at large scales. And so community science, citizen science is absolutely critical. And that's a good segue maybe into a project that I wanted to plug. And that is, we have a new project that just started. It's a jumping worm survey and outreach project that is funded through a Baldwin grant through campus. And the idea with this is to engage the gardening community in Wisconsin to tell us just simply, what are you observing in your backyard garden, in your community garden? And so we're looking for participants to help just to do a survey and maybe a follow-up focus group, so that we can kind of, as a community, create a network and share our observations. And the end result of this project is hopefully to create a list of plants that, may have some resilience to jumping worm effects, and maybe a list of plants that we know are really impacted. Whether it's plant families or plant traits that, gardeners should avoid in their landscaping or in their vegetable growing. And so if there's folks listening that are interested in being a part of this, if you go to our website, arboretum.wisc.edu, right front and center is a picture of a jumping worm, and you can click on that, and it'll take you to a link to sign up for that survey when it comes out.
Yeah, we also have that link at wpr.org/mornings. Let's bring in John in Glendale. John, hi.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if these worms are a problem in their native lands, and if so, how they control them.
Yeah, that's a great question, John, and I get that one a lot, too. And so with just like other invasive species, every species is native to somewhere, and in their native areas, just like jumping worms, they are often not an issue. And that's the case with this group of earthworms. You know, in Japan and Korea, where the ones we have in the U.S. are mostly found, they are not a problem, and they're actually not found very often in forests. They're more often found on the edge of forests or in meadows. And they, you know, we don't know why they're not invasive necessarily in their native land, other than there's probably some sort of native biological control, whether it's a fungus, animal species. There's many different species of jumping worms, and so there might be some sort of you know, intra-species competition that keeps them all in check. And, you know, they just don't have whatever it is, that predator, that environmental change is not here. And so they found a niche to take over, and they do it very well. It's a great question. We don't know exactly why they're not invasive in their native range, but that's often the case with these species that become invasive here.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kate.
Brad Herrick, he is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. We have a link to that Arboretum's Jumping Worm Survey outreach that is underway, as Brad talked about. Find it at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we discuss virtual reality police training and how it's helping agencies respond to crisis situations. Has your police department or your organization ever used a VR simulator for training? What did you think of it? What were the outcomes? 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. And now to a Wisconsin Watch and WPR investigation that found that an Outagamie County judge used a sentencing practice that let people avoid jail time if they followed his rules. Judge Vincent Biskupic has offered stays or furloughs in at least 30 cases. It's a practice some experts say is legally questionable. Phoebe Petrovic reports.
After the Wisconsin Department of Corrections revoked Bo James' probation, he went before Outagamie County Circuit Judge Vincent Biskupic to receive his sentence. Biskupic is well known in legal circles. He was the Outagamie County District Attorney for 8 years and unsuccessfully ran for Attorney General in 2002. Biskupic gave James a year in jail. The next month, he let James back out, provided he complied with 5 rules.
At first, I was happy about it. You know, I got to save my apartment. I got to save what I've earned, what I've worked so hard for.
Every few months, Biskupic ordered the young man back to court to ask if he was working, getting counseling, staying sober, and above all, studying for his GED. Skipping these check-ins could have landed James back in jail, so he went.
I had everything going for myself, but he continued and continued and continued because I didn't have my GED.
For 19 months, James lived in a sort of legal purgatory, tethered to Biskupic's court by review hearings and rules, and burdened by the remaining jail sentence hanging over his head. Biskupic used a stay, a tool which pauses or postpones a sentence. Wisconsin law allows judges to stay sentences to put people on probation with the Department of Corrections, but that's not what this was, because the department had already revoked James' probation.
Pretty much what the stay was still continuing probation just through the judge.
More than 24 attorneys, judges, and law professors interviewed had mixed opinions about whether this practice, used by a handful of judges in Wisconsin, is legal. Several said they had never encountered it. Biskupic did not answer detailed questions about the practice. In a statement, he said he considers all sentencing options, including ways for defendants to attend treatment. In an email, Biskupic's attorney defended the judge's actions, insisting that earlier court rulings permit them. Cecilia Klingel is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Law School. She described Biskupic's review hearings as a gray area of the law.
clearly what the courts are trying to do here is create alternative sentencing mechanisms, which on their merits may be terrific. Whether they can stand or whether we need statutory revision in order for them to be recognized is just not entirely clear.
Wisconsin law limits the types of sentences judges can issue. But Brown County Circuit Judge Donald Zeidmulder says you won't find these arrangements in the statutes. He says they're rare, but legal.
This is just part of what comes with judicial authority. We're a third branch, and so we do have some inherent powers.
Others disagree. Deja Vishny, a defense attorney and adjunct professor at Marquette University Law School, reviewed appeals and Supreme Court rulings that Biskupic's attorney says authorized these unusual arrangements.
So there are really limited circumstances under which it can be done. But deciding that you're going to be the probation agent for the person is not one of them. So he just has absolutely no authority to do what he's doing.
Still, some attorneys and defendants say they appreciated the arrangement, especially if they got to avoid jail. Biskupic's oversight had fewer rules than regular probation, but also fewer checks and balances on the judge's power. Bo James considered appealing after Biskupic sent him back to jail, but his attorney worried the ordeal might end before a higher court could weigh in. James later sued Biskupic in federal court, alleging the stay was illegal, but a magistrate judge threw it out. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Phoebe Petrovic.
Now to the growth of virtual reality, or VR, used to train the next generation of police officers. These simulators, they're meant to help officers anticipate and respond to high-risk situations, recreating real-world police encounters. Do you work in law enforcement? What are your thoughts on VR training? Have you used a VR system for training in your organization? How did it go over? Join in 800-642-1234. Nick Alexander is Chief of Police for the Superior Police Department. Chief Alexander, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. We also have Brian Hong, who is CEO of the VR police training firm called Survivor. Brian, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Brian, let's start with you. Walk us through what happens when you put on that VR headset. What would an officer experience?
That's a great question. So once you put on a headset, you are essentially you're immersed in a completely new world. Virtual reality is a very powerful medium of conveying content. And so I could place you on the top of Mars or in the middle of forest or at the bottom of the ocean. And in this case, where we use virtual reality for police training, we can put you in the middle of any scenario that you could possibly come across in the real world, be it an emotionally disturbed individual scenario, a domestic violence situation, a traffic stop, God forbid, an active shooter, anything that it may be that you need to train for as an officer. And it's fully immersive. You can see in front, behind, you can move around the environment and interact with it. It is essentially as realistic of a training scenario as you can get.
Chief Alexander, you're using VR as part of your training in Superior. Can you explain what you're doing with it?
Sure. So, over the course of time, police training's evolved. When I started 24 years ago, we regularly went out to the range and just stood in front of targets and practiced marksmanship. When we would work on kind of the hands-on training, the control tactics and defensive arrest tactics, we were usually using, padded bags and so on, where another officer was holding it. Those are great for motor skills and learning technique, but they don't replicate how they're used out in the real world, out on the street. They generally don't require the use of communication to try to de-escalate scenarios and so on. So over time, we've moved to trying to bring in some reality or scenario-based training to the department. However, there's complications with that. It's expensive. It's difficult to organize. You have to bring in actors or have extra bodies to be role players. And it was much better than just simply the technical skills training that we did. However, it was predictable. An officer would go into a scenario and somebody in that scenario would be wearing a large padded suit we call a red man suit. So it kind of, was, it created
it was a giveaway.
A giveaway that
what's going to happen.
What's going to happen. So And we could do those a couple times a year. But, you know, I've always believed, you know, to be progressive in policing, we need to, you know, provide the best quality training and at, you know, more frequent intervals to be able to train our officers. And that's exactly what the VR system allows us to do. We can take officers, you know, right after a roll call, take a couple of them, run them through, you know, 15, 20 minutes of scenarios, and, you know, then they can go back and work their assigned area on the street, and we can rotate other officers in. So the biggest thing is, you know, you look at athletic training and physical fitness and so on, it's about repetitions. And that's really what we're going to be able to do. We're going to be able to expose our officers to a greater number of scenarios that are realistic, that have a high focus on de-escalation and professional communications, to better prepare them for the types of calls that they actually experience out on the street.
Brian, what do you make of that repetitive nature of it? And, you know, the fact that pilots, of course, use VR to hone their skills, surgeons use VR. Do you think that this training tool will become more embedded in officer training?
Absolutely. You know, training is everything. Repetition is everything. And officers behave how they're trained. And so I think there are multiple different dimensions here. There's the repetitions of training, but also you can dig deeper and kind of look at, you know, what's the quality of each repetition? To what extent is it predictable and insightful? And so if you look at how most of the traditional police simulators today are like, it's essentially huge TV screens that will play videos on there. And you as a trainee, you're standing on the stage and watching and interacting with this 2D screen that's playing a video. And yeah, I've been in it myself. It works fine. But again, a video by definition plays from start to end. It does not care what you say or what you do. There's very limited branching available. And the predictability can get down to a point where once you run through a scenario, you kind of know what the outcome is if they play that same one again. So, for example, if an individual comes out and they're wearing a certain shirt versus a different kind of shirt, you are actually able to tell ahead of time what they're going to do. And so it removes the tension from the scenario. And so with what we do differently with this simulator, other than allowing to increase your training repetitions, is, you know, we designed this in such a way that each scenario can be modified in real time at every different second, what the suspect can say or do. And so for the first time ever, you as a training, you have no idea what's going to happen. And you can have a realistic back and forth conversation with the suspect. And so you can run through 1,000 scenarios and have them end 1,000 different ways. And that's the beauty of what we've built.
But I'm wondering, when you build these simulations, Brian, are you basing these simulations on real police encounters that perhaps are in the headlines, maybe examples of when officers have made decisions that led to injury or death of the suspect?
Yeah, our training scenarios, they are extremely customizable and moldable. Again, the training instructor has full control over how to shape each scenario, how to set it up, and ultimately what the suspect says and does. And so you can take our traffic stop scenario platform and mold it into a traffic stop scenario that's very similar to what has actually happened in the real world. And you can do this with any of the platforms we have out there today, domestic violence, whatever it may be.
Chief Alexander, what is your take there on shaping these scenarios to work on things you really want to work on with your officers?
Sure. You know, that was probably one of the primary reasons we went with the Survive VR product, was the ability to, you know, mold each scenario in really a, you know, an infinite number of ways. Our focus in our training for the past few years and continues to be is on de-escalation and professional communication. So we want our officers to be able to engage in dialogue, and we want the training system to, you know, recognize, you know, are they being successful with that or not? And then, you know, have the situation evolve based off of, you know, their success in using those skills. So that was a real important factor of it, because, you know, in the past, Brian had mentioned some other police simulators, and they really were really geared towards shoot scenarios. And that's just not, you know, a typical event in policing. They get a lot of media attention, but when you look at the millions of calls for service that police departments respond to every year, use of force ones are relatively small. But officers being able to de-escalate and talk people in calm situations is far more the norm. And we want to use this system to be able to hone in on those skills and better prepare officers to have successful outcomes, even in stressful situations that, you know, don't end up in a use of force. And, you know, Brian mentioned also the tension or stress, you know, bringing stress into these situations. And that's really what the VR does, because of the unpredictable nature of it. It is more like, real police work out on the street, where it does create a heightened level of stress in the officers and requires them to also, work on their critical decision making.
That stress, not knowing what might happen next. And sounds like, as well as building these communication skills of the officers, Chief Alexander.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're talking with Nick Alexander, Chief of Police for Superior PD, Brian Hong, founder of a virtual reality police training startup based in Dallas. Do you work in law enforcement? How do you think your agency has responded to the feedback officers have received in recent years? What kinds of training have you received? Is VR an option? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the future of virtual reality or VR simulations for police officers, putting officers through the paces of these complex scenarios and critical decision-making that occurs before and after they respond to a call. Is VR simulation part of your training technology? What, with calls to reform policing in America, is VR a viable tool for improving police responses? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. Brian Hong founded a VR police training firm in Dallas. Nick Alexander is chief of police for Superior PD, and they're with us for about eight more minutes. I want to look at how you track outcomes, Brian. How do you measure whether VR training is actually making an impact on police performance on the job? Can you go into that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm sure the chief can touch on it more. Reiterating on what we discussed earlier, we believe that the best training comes through repetition. Studies have already demonstrated that virtual reality technology itself as a medium of learning and content communication can greatly increase retention rates. And the studies all show varying amounts, but, you know, it can go as much as 50% and higher improvement compared to if you were running similar training through, an online module or anything involving a 2D screen, which distances you from the content itself. It's not immersive. You're not really having a hands-on impact. It doesn't feel like you're there.
Hmm. Chief Alexander, what do you see in terms of how you know this VR training is worth it? How do you measure success?
Well, sure. So, you know, obviously we have instructors, you know, who have higher levels of, you know, training in the specific skills that officers use. So they're involved in running the scenarios. But one of the nice features is that it has a body cam feature, much like our officers wear body cams, where it's actually recording the entire training scenario, or the instructor and the officer can go back and review what they did and what they maybe saw or things that they didn't see. We can figure out where, you know, what was their focus of attention. And we can rerun those scenarios after there's been some discussion about it and give the officer another chance to do it. So I do think, it's a combination of repetition and the ability to, go back and look and, what things did you do really well and what areas maybe could you improve on? And then, running a scenario again, and as we've already mentioned, it won't be exactly the same. It's not going to be scripted. It isn't, run from the beginning to the end. It can change up, but it just gives the officers the ability to hone in on those skills.
How does it get at implicit biases and those issues? Can you explain how you're looking at that, Chief?
Yeah, obviously that's kind of a, an important topic, something that's been given a lot of public attention recently. And, everybody has implicit biases. Sometimes it's the word itself seems to have a negative connotation, but we all do. We're products of our environment, our upbringings, and so on. And, the scenario-based trainer, allows us to bring in probably greater cultural diversity than we experience in our own community in terms of having interactions with, people from all walks of life, all races, all backgrounds, and so on. And, certainly there's the ability to track our when officers are engaging in scenarios with persons of color, perhaps, are the outcomes differently? And if so, if we can identify that, then we can work on training to address that.
Brian, your thoughts there on how you approach bias through the VR training?
Exposure is something that we all always focus on internally. And so we make sure that that officers constantly have the biggest diversity of different scenarios and individuals and cultures available to them through the training. And so, the different suspects you may encounter or subjects, they will vary by skin color, by gender. Even we're always adding more variables for variability, such as even clothing. And so, we want to make sure that the training content and the individuals that our trainees come across in our simulator are as multidimensional as possible. And we're always building out more features around this, making sure that that you have as many different individuals you're interacting with as possible in as many different environments and cultures as possible. And that's something that we're being cognizant of even more as we start to get attention from overseas law enforcement. How do we properly mold this training around completely entire nations and cultures? How do we respect local customs and languages and make sure that we're not unintentionally biasing our training in the completely wrong direction?
Something I want to hopefully pose to both of you. We only have a few seconds, though. I'm wondering, Chief Alexander, what is holding VR back now? What can't it do for police departments?
Well, obviously as technology improves, it'll get better and better. I definitely think it's at a point now where it is very realistic. One really great feature of the Survive VR one is that they're going to come to our community and map out or scan an area of our choosing. So, besides just being, scenarios that are created in albeit realistic environments, we're actually going to be able to bring one of our local areas, whether it be, an intersection or maybe a building that we commonly respond to. So, making it to that personal level. And I think over time, that'll be something that we see increase as well. Obviously, there's a cost issue. Training is expensive, but we really looked at this as over time being something that, albeit there was an upfront expense, over time, we do think it's going to save money and allow us to do more training more financially responsibly.
Thank you both for joining us. Nick Alexander is Chief of Police in Superior. Brian Hong is CEO of the virtual reality police training simulation firm called Survivor. Stay with us as we kick off our home improvement series here on the Ideas Network.